consecutive technical fouls by Joe Crawford. And Don.
Two, you out of
it. Up in there, nothing happens.
It's hard.
It was the same ride.
No, kids. Kobe's trying to get to the basket.
Devin was trying
Wait
to get
a
to
minute.
The
a to B, and he winds up at C.
That's the same
Devin
thing.
Devin, who?
Oh, come on now.
No, I'm serious. I don't even know what you're talking about. Which player you're talking about?
Welcome back. It is Saturday at noon. Ray Dinger, Glenn Mack now, and a time we always look forward to. Tell us your story. And what a fun one we have today. Nobody in NBA history officiated more playoff games than Joey Crawford over his 39-year career. The Havertown native called fouls in more than 2,500 regular season games, 374 playoff games, and 50 NBA finals. Crawford's father, Shag Crawford, was a major league umpire for more than 20 years. His brother, a major league umpire as well, and we are delighted today to be joined by our own local Delaware County's Joe Crawford. How are you today?
Awesome, Glenn. Thank you for having me. You and Ray, appreciate it.
That's our pleasure. So we always like to start at the beginning, and I want to talk about growing up in a house where your father was a major league umpire. That must have been, I mean, that's not when they have career day and kids talk about what their dads do. Most don't get to give that. What was that like?
You know, I thought everybody's father was an umpire. You know, what did I know? It was, you know, it was awesome, to be honest. It, I was a baseball degenerate because of my dad, and going to games and things like that, it was just awesome. It was an awesome existence. And in the summertime, obviously, great when he was working the Phillies, he always went to the games every game in the series, which was awesome. You know, going to, you know, back then it was Connie Mack and Fett Stadium, but it was fabulous. It really, and we didn't even, you know, we didn't see him for 6 or 7 months. You know, as soon as when he left for spring training, that was it. He was gone. It's not like today. Today, I think the umpires in Major League Baseball get a week off every 7 weeks. But my father, you didn't see him unless he worked the Phillies, and it was great. I mean, you know, it was really cool. It was being a baseball guy. It was perfect. I loved it.
I can imagine. The one thing I would wonder though, Joe, would be. I mean, when your dad's working games at Connie Mack, obviously you're probably going to be there, and you're probably 9, 10, 11 years old. What is it like for you to be in the stands hearing people hollering things at your father?
You know, my father was a real professional guy, and he was obsessed with officiating. And he made sure that didn't cheer. If somebody did say something about the umpires, you didn't respond because he didn't want anybody in the stands to think that he was pro-Philly or... So you just sat there like a gnome, you know? If Philly's got a hit or somebody hit a home run, I never cheered. And it was all because of my dad. And even today, if I go to a baseball game, my wife hates it because she says, you just sit there and you don't cheer, you know? you just watch the game. And it was all because of him. He was so cognizant of the fact that somebody might say something negative because he was from Philly and you were sitting in the stands and you cheered for the Phillies. But I, you know... I just didn't respond if somebody hollered something, Shag, you suck, or something like that. It, you know, and in Philly, you know, you heard everything. And sure. I just didn't respond. You just didn't.
So
because I was afraid of what would happen afterwards if I told him. I said, Dad, I told this guy, you know, he was screaming at you. He would have got really angry at me. You know,
yeah.
I never said a word.
So in the late 60s, you attend Cardinal O'Hara High School, and it turns out there's three
Lions,
other...
The Lions of Cardinal O'Hara.
There you go. There's three other NBA referees who attend there, not all the same time as you, and we'll discuss that a little bit later. But again, you got the dad who's the ump, the brother who's the ump. You go to school to all these guys who are future NBA referees. What's in the water out there in Delaware County? What's going on?
Well, you know, Glenn, I talk about this a lot. I was fortunate being from Delaware County, and I took up refereeing, that you had Jake O'Donnell from Clifton. You had Eddie Middleton from Ardmore. You had Joe Gushue from Philly. And these people were a phone call away so you could talk to them about officiating. If you were interested in the NBA, as I was as a young kid, to try to get to that level as a ref, Jake came to see me ref. I'm working a CYO game out in Mother of Good Counsel out on Lancaster Avenue, and he came to see me work. And that's the same thing with the people from around here. If someone reached out to me, I always went to watch them work. Now it's easier because you have the computer. You can sit and watch referees and the convenience of your house. But those Eddie Malloy and Duke Callahan, and they were really terrific referees. Mm-hmm. You knew right off the bat that they were no-brainers. But there has been numerous people that I told that they weren't NBA referees. So that's hard,
yeah.
But that's what you do. You just say, hey, there's nothing wrong with being a high school ref or a college ref. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's I think when you have the numbers that we had from this area, it's easier to get tutelage. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, sure. Yeah, the network grows.
Yeah, and it was really terrific. It was terrific to live here.
I'm wondering the obviously the influence with your dad, who was not just a major league umpire, but a major league umpire of terrific prominence. I mean, your dad was a major league ump for more than 20 years, worked a lot of big games, worked a lot of big World Series games that were memorable. He had a very distinctive style behind the plate. He was in that low crouch, like resting right on the catcher's back. Everybody knew who he was.
And good, Ray. Very good.
Well, I saw it so many times, Joe. I saw him work so many games. And then, of course, your brother became a baseball umpire as well. But you went the other way.
Yeah.
I mean, you decided you went to basketball. Why was that? Because it would have seemed like baseball would have made more sense.
I loved baseball. Do not get me wrong. And I still watch baseball games constantly. I love it. But the officiating end of it, I grew up, I went to St. Pius X in Broomall. But I hung a lot with the guys down in Havertown. And there was a playground right next to the school. And all we did was play basketball. I mean, constantly. And then the palestra. So I just really gravitated towards it. I really, really liked it. And I said to my dad, I was a kid. I was only like 14, 15, 16 years old. I said, I'd really like to, you know, ref. And I just started to, he told me, he says, Joey, just watch the refs. And we were lucky back then. I don't know if you guys remember, but when I was 14, 15 years old, so we're talking in the early 60s. The Sixers did have a TV contract. I think it was on UHF.
Yeah, Channel 17.
I used to watch the games on TV, and then on Sundays watch games. And I would watch Strom, and I would watch Gushue, and I would watch Eddie Rush, and I would watch those guys. And, you know, if I go to the Palestra, I would watch Hanzo. I would watch Grossman. I would watch Herniak. And that was just what I did. I really, really loved the officiating end of it. But it was because of really the area that I grew up in. Everybody was a basketball people.
It's fascinating. I mean, it's such a different approach to sports than most kids take. So you start reffing. right out of high school, and I know you're going from gym to gym, and then you're working the Eastern League, and then you got to the NBA. You're 25. What was the big break?
You know, I was lucky. I was working in the Eastern League on the weekends and working everything around Philly, publicly, Catholic League. And I was working in the Baker League. I got in the Baker League. Sonny Hill let me work those games so in the summertime. So I was working, you know, pro basketball. And I was scouted. I was scouted by a guy, Sid Borgia, who was an old-time NBA ref. And Sid, you used to handwrite your schedule and send it to Sid. And he'd either come to he actually came and watched me in a doubleheader in Memorial Hall. And he would get on the baseline as the game is going on, and I would run down to the baseline, and he'd grab me by my pants, and he'd be moving me as the game is going on. But Sid really liked me. He took a liking. You know, I had that pizzazz. And back then, Glenn and Ray, most people that took up NBA refereeing were older. But I was a young guy who had, I knew at like 22 because I kept watching all the pro refs, how they called an offensive foul, how they called a loose ball foul, how they called goaltending. I don't know how many of them I was getting right. But I actually looked the part. And then when you're a young guy, wow, this kid's really talented. You know, people, they catch up to you, your talent level, but I was that guy who really came across, wow, this young guy's hustles, he gets up and down the floor, he looks the part, and that's why they hired me.
That's great.
Did you find, because you do get to the NBA at an early age, as a young guy, and you had paid your dues, like Glenn said. I mean, you had worked the Baker League, you had worked the Eastern League, where there's a lot of tough gyms and a lot of tough crowds. But you get to
tough nights.
Yeah. I'm sure there were. I've heard Sonny Hill tell the stories. But when you get to the NBA, when you get to the NBA and you're still that young a guy, did you find the veteran players, because it was an older league? I mean, it was a league of older veteran players. Did you find they tried to take any kind of advantage of you because they thought you were just this kid off the street?
Brutal. They had no. My first 5 years in the NBA, I was distraught most nights. I had no idea. But I was so lucky. Joe Gushue, a Philly guy, Kensington guy, he took me under his. I mean, I don't know what I'd do without that guy. And I was distraught. I mean, I was calling technical fouls after technical fouls. I was ejecting people. I tell a story. I walked in the locker room. I think it was my third year in the league. I was in Chicago, and Al Addles was probably the greatest guy I have ever met in professional basketball. He's coaching Golden State at the time, and I eject him on an out-of-bounds play. And I walked into the locker room after the game, and I just sat there, and I put my head in my hands, and I went, I don't know about this. And my partner was a guy by the name of Bob Rakel, who lived in Cincinnati, and he didn't get it, you know. And he's looking at me, he says, what's the matter? I said, Bob, I just threw out Al Addles. He said, don't you get it? I said, we're not talking about somebody that's, you know, a crazy man on the sideline. Al Addles. And I was distraught. And I would call Joe Gushue all the time. You know, we didn't have cell phones back then. Mm-hmm. You know, so you get to the hotel or I'd wait till I get home and I'd call Joe and I'm figuring I'm going to get some kind of, you know, sympathy. Joe would just eat me up. He would just annihilate me. He'd scream at me. he used to call me some dirty names, but he was the best thing that ever happened to me. He said, "Listen, you got talent." He said, "You just go out and you just keep doing what you're doing." He said, "They'll accept it sooner or later." But I was beside myself. I really was. Those first 5 years was hard, hard.
Well, you're also a kid, and so you're learning confidence. I mean, most of the fans who watched you over the years know you as a mature ref and so on. But when you were starting out, I saw a great story that you told that I'd love you to give, which is I guess it was your third year, and you're playing in L.A., and there's Jack Nicholson right by the warm-up table where you are. Give us that moment, if you would.
You know, I told it again the other day. You know, you get into the league and you know, I watched this guy. One of my favorite movies of all time was Easy Rider. Mm-hmm. You know, and I watched it, and Jack's in it. And I'm not that guy that's looking to say hello or go over to hug Jack Nicholson. I know my place. I'm in the league a couple of years, and I don't know that he knows me. I have no idea. So right where we took our warm-up jacket off, Jack sat there. Jack used to sit there with a guy by the name of Lou Adler, who's a music producer, another wonderful man. So I never said anything to him, but Joe Gashue would talk to him, Earl Strom would talk to him, Hubert Evans would talk to him, but I didn't talk to him. So it's like my third year. I pulled the jacket off, I put the jacket down, and I catch Jack's eye. And I just go, "How you doing, Jack?" And he looks at me and he goes, "How you doing, Joe?" And I don't say anything, but inside I'm going like this: Jack Nicholson knows me. It's unbelievable. You know, yep. I can't wait to get back to the hotel. And now it's 3 hour difference. You know what I mean? So I call my wife. I said, "Jack Nicholson knows me." She goes, "Do you know what time it is?" I said, "I don't care, Mary. Jack Nicholson knows me." But it was awesome. It was awesome. It might be my favorite moment as a ref.
That's great.
Did you? I'm assuming with as many games as you worked at Madison Square Garden, you probably got on a first name basis with Spike Lee as well. What was your relationship with Spike?
Ray, I used to talk to him all the time. He's just one of those avid fans. He's a great dude. I mean, is he hollering at you when you're reffing? Of course. Hey, you're sitting that front row like that, you're paying that kind of money, you can holler all you want. But he's really a nice man. He's just a basketball guy. He loves the game. He loves his team. You know, you don't mind fans like that. You really don't. You like it, in fact. You want every arena to be sold out, 19,000. You want them to be. That means the sport's doing well. That's how you look at it.
Joey Crawford is our guest, the great – it's funny, Ray, you and I have been talking about having a referee on for a while, and I'm glad we are, the longtime famous NBA ref. Our pleasure. You talked earlier about how you were a hothead when you were a younger referee, and you got a reputation as a whistleblower and as a sometimes angry guy. You have worked, or you did work, when you were doing the job with a local sports psychologist, Dr. Joel Fish. What did you learn from him? What did you get out of that?
You know, Joel was a godsend to me. I talked very openly about it because it really, really helped me. I didn't know why I did the things that I did on the court. Some things I was not proud of. If a player said something to me, I would, you know, maybe say something back, and which I shouldn't have done, or eject somebody where I shouldn't have done. And then when I got suspended over the Tim Duncan thing, I really pursued a relationship with Joel and spoke to him on an ongoing basis. I just wanted to know why I did what the things that I did under pressure, because I'm not like that at home. You know, I'm not like that out in the world. And Joel really you know, he said, Joe, your problem, a lot of it is passion for your profession, which my father gave me. But he just would give me different exercises to use on the court. And, you know, where when I would feel myself going, put your hands behind your back, something that would tell you in your mind, Joe, calm down. And it was the best thing I ever did to actually go and just be able to talk to Joel. Because what happens is you start to think, wow, am I really that? Am I really nuts? Am I really this crazy man? And he was awesome. I mean, he was just, I talk about him all the time. In fact, I texted him. We texted one another about a month ago. We stay in some sort of touch. He's just a great guy. Wonderful man.
Just to clarify, we got about 1 minute before the break. The Tim Duncan thing, not to belabor it, but you called a couple tees on him on the bench, and it ended up you challenged him to a fight. Is that correct?
The challenge of the fight is accurate, but I said it in this term, being a Philly guy, yeah, I'm not stupid. A 6'10 guy could kick my tush. I'm 5'10. So I looked at him, and after I called the two T's and he was still hollering, and I looked at him, I said, you want to fight me? Is that what you want? And that was the tone. That was how I used it. But it was the Philly term. I knew I was going to get my, if I fought somebody like that, I would get killed. I know that. But it was, you know, what you're trying to do, being a guy from Philly, I'm just as tough as you. You know, really, I'm a coward. You know, the only reason I was tough is because I had the whistle in my mouth. But that's it.
Joey Crawford is our guest. We come back, we're going to talk about some of the great moments he got to officiate, some of the favorite players he got to work with. Ray Dinger, Glenn Mack now. Tell us your story on 94 WIP.
Run.
No, you know there's no conference with these guys.
No. I got this. I got a tech on him and a tech on him. Tech, right there.
Well, that voice that you hear is the great Joey Crawford, longtime legendary NBA referee, local guy, our guest today on Tell Us Your Story. Ray?
Yeah, Joe, when people think about you, they think about on the court that you, you were not shy about handing out technical fouls. You were not shy about ejecting people. That became sort of part of your persona. But I'm just wondering, what was the point where you would not allow somebody to cross over a line? Everybody has a line, and during the course of a game, I'm sure all players are saying things to you about calls and stuff, and it probably gets a little heated and a little animated, but at what point does a guy step over the line where you feel like you got to technical him or maybe eject him? What is that line in your mind?
You know, Ray, again, great question. I'm not real proud of my reputation, but there are certain things that happen in a game that irked me, and it's almost like I would never say to Billy Cunningham, if he was coaching on the sidelines, or Doc Rivers or anybody like that, I would never question their, you know, timeouts, their substitutions, those types of things, because it's not my expertise. My expertise is refereeing. So when I was questioned and I would answer the question, and then you would get the bully back where somebody says, you're full of, that would anger me because I would say to them, well, why would you ask me the question? I gave you the answer and now you don't like the answer. So now you come back at me where I should have. You know, it's a woulda, coulda, shoulda thing. You know, and Joel helped me with that, too. It's just run down the court. Run down the court. That's where I would sometimes hit somebody with technical fouls. Or you don't have to curse, really, as a player or coach. They know when they want to take. They really do. If they're constantly complaining, every play, if they're complaining about Joe, that was an offensive foul. Hey, Joe, he's holding me. Hey, Joe, he hit me with his knee. you finally, what you do is you say, I'm in that job now. I have to teach it. That's my position now. Is this, you have to say, listen, that's it. Now you warn them. Next time somebody says something, you hit them with a technical foul. It's always easy when somebody curses you. When they curse you, that's automatic. I mean, you have to hit them with a technical foul because now you lose. That's why you're out there. You're out there to run the game. You're not out there to just placate people and let everybody say what every player or coach say whatever they want to say. Yeah. So that's your job. Your job is to run the game. So if you let somebody curse you, now you have all those players out there that said, oh, Joe's open season. And I learned all that. All that stuff was passed down to me from the guys from Philly, Jake and Gashu and Strom. That's how they ref the game. And that's how they taught me.
Joe, let's talk about some of the guys over the years who were your favorite players and then some of the guys who were the biggest challenges. And I've heard you before, and like a lot of people around the league, I've heard you start with Charles Barkley.
Yeah, I just always thought – see, the amazing thing is Charles got a lot of tees. He got a lot of tees. Tees have nothing to do with anything. Rasheed Wallace got a lot of tees. I like both guys. They just went out and competed. They competed. That had nothing to do with anything. Most times, the player that is the difficult player to deal with is the player that is bringing up a situation from a previous game, a previous year. They're the ones that they're not forgetting it. Charles and Rasheed, they forgot it. They went out. They just played. They knew when they wanted to get a T. They knew when they wanted to get ejected. That's all part of the game. The person that's tough to deal with, and coaches are involved too, are the ones that never let it go. They never let it go because refs let it go because they give T's and they eject people. We do it more than the coach or the player gets teased and gets ejected. I've had numerous players through the years. They could be out of the league 20 years and see me out in Vegas because I'm out there in Vegas in the summertime in our summer league teaching officiating, and I'll see them out there. And they'll come, do you remember the time, Joe, you've called the team? They remember 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And it fascinates me. Because I really don't remember. But they think you do, and that's the paranoia.
Meant more to them than it did to you. So
well,
hold on.
Yeah,
so,
because, yeah, we do. Yeah, you do it so much.
Right. It's part of your job. I want to go over a couple of names and just get your kind of snapshot of them. Charles Barkley being one. And I know you said Moses was one of your favorite and Manute. So give us just your little snapshots of those three.
Well, Charles was just awesome. He forgot if you ejected them the night before and you had them the next week, it was over. They just played. Moses to me had the greatest sense of humor. I mean, we were in Dallas. He's playing with Phillies with Dr. J. And people wouldn't talk to Moses because they thought he was like standoffish, but he was far from it. And his sense of humor was fabulous. So Doc has the ball and he wheels on the baseline and his foot goes on the line. So I give the ball back to Dallas. Moses is under his breath. He's going like this. And remember how he talked real low? Moses went like this. He said, "Well, to put people on the line." And I'm looking, I didn't know what he said. And Doc is standing next to him, and he said, "I said, Doc, Doc's laughing." And I said, "Doc, what'd he say?" He said, "Joe, he said, you know the tennis. Remember back in the tennis days where they had when the ball hit the line and the beeper went off." Moses went, "They ought to put a beeper on the line." And now I start crying, laughing, and we're running up the floor, and we're all the three of us were laughing. But he was so his sense of humor was fabulous. and people didn't understand it. They didn't know it. Manute was just one of those guys that was just, he knew that he was 7'7", but he actually could play some. And the better days that he had was when he was playing at Golden State, and Don Nelson used to let him take threes. And I used to sit, I'd stand there, and he'd take a three, and I chuckled to myself. So he'd hit the three, and we're running down the floor, and I'd look at him. I said, "You got to be kidding me, right?" And he'd look at me, and he'd go, and he put his finger up, and he'd go, "Number one center in the league, Manute Bol."
You know,
I love the guy. He was awesome to deal with. But there were so many more. Rick Mahorn was awesome. And Jeff Rulin, they were just great. They would beat the hell out of one another, but they were fabulous human beings. And you see them today. I talked to both of those guys even today, and they're just fabulous. They just talk about the old days and what used to happen on the court. Really fun times.
I remember Steve Javy, who's another one of these, one of the guys, sort of one of the Delco brotherhood of referees.
Yeah. One of my best friends in the world.
And you helped, and he says you helped break him in. I mean, he said that you kind of took him under your wing and taught him how to do this. But I remember he ejected a radio announcer from a game one time. I forget where it was, Utah or somewhere, but whoever the radio announcer was, Steve had said, "I've had enough of you," and threw him out of the game. Have you ever thrown any of the radio or TV people out?
No, that was Steve ejected Mike Rice, whose son, I think, 20 years later, was the coach of Rutgers. And Mike was the broadcaster for Portland, and Mike was hard on refs. And I think the story was he actually, you know, remember when the radio guys were courtside,
right?
And Mike stood up on Steve when he calls up to him, and Steve went over and threw him off the sideline. And he called me and told me what he did. I said, "Are you a nitwit throwing that guy over the sideline?" And he also, Steve threw out the guy down in Washington who was the guy that's like the Philly Fanatic.
The mascot.
Steve threw him out. Yeah, Steve threw him out.
Did you ever toss a mascot? Did you ever toss a mascot,
no,
Joe?
No, I never did. No, I had enough problem with the players and the coaches. I didn't radio people.
Joey, we've talked about some of the players, and really already some of the great players, when you mentioned Charles Barkley and Moses Malone. But I'm just curious, the biggest names in the game over the term of your career, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, were they as a group any different, any better, any worse, easier, harder? What were your relationships with the true superstars?
Well, a lot of the fallacies are is that superstars get the calls and they get this, they get that. You know, come on, truth be told is, they're superstars because they have the ball most of the time. So if the referee's going to screw something up, it's going to be with Magic involved, Bird involved, Jordan involved. Those guys just played. They just played the game. Magic, I was so lucky to ref all those guys. Kareem, Olajuwon, Isaiah Thomas, all those guys, they just played the game. Did you have beefs with them? Did you call technical fouls on them? Of course. But they just played. They just played the game. They got to the next play. That's what the NBA is. That's what referees tell themselves. You know when you screw up a play, and you just say to yourself, let's get to the next clock. We would say, let's get to the next 24 seconds because of our 24-second clock. But that's our game. The technical foul thing and the interactions with players and coaches is all part of our game because this isn't we're part of this game because it's our livelihood. A college ref, I mean, they may have a job or somebody might be able to redline them and get rid of them. Or we don't have that in the NBA. You're an NBA ref. I have a game and I have an ejection in November, I'm still going to see that team in December, January, February, and March. So I told Iverson this one night, who was not a bad guy. He had a tough time with referees, but he really wasn't a bad guy. It was earlier in his career. He was having difficulties with some refs. I came, and me being included, and I came out on the court, and he's the captain, and you go over to, you have your captain's meeting 5 minutes before the tip. And I said to him, Alan, do you know anything about NBA refs? And he said, no. I said, do you know that we do this for a living? This is our job. This is what we do. This is how our kids eat. And he goes, he was just looking at me, you know, because a lot of the younger players don't know. They don't know what the dynamics are. I said to him, Alan, if you're here 15 years, I'm going to be here 15 years. So we got to find a way where we can, you know, cope and do this together. Mm-hmm. And that's really what you're trying to do, because you're going to have beefs. It's part of official player coach rapport. And so you got to be able to deal with it.
Joe, if we talked at the beginning, by way of introduction, the fact that you reffed over 2,500 regular season games and you worked 374 playoff games, most of anybody, and you're a basketball historian to the hilt for sure. If you look back over basketball history, is there one game, and I asked you, is there one game that was played that you didn't ref that you wish, if you had the opportunity, you could have reffed?
Wow, I've been asked a lot of stuff, Ray. That's I've never been asked that. Yes, it just hit me. I would have loved to have reffed the game that was the worst, in my opinion, the worst thing that happened to our sport, the Malice in the Palace.
Oh, yeah.
I think, and I'm trying not to be an egomaniac here. I think I would have liked to have been there, because I think it wouldn't have transpired the way it did, because our three referees in that game didn't do very well. They caused a lot of that problem. And it wasn't on calls or anything. It was at the end where, when Ben Wallace and Ron Artest went at one another. I think if I was at that game, I would have did numerous things differently.
Okay.
I don't know if that is a lot of people might not understand that, but a referee's mind, I would have loved to have been there, and maybe we wouldn't have had the embarrassment to our sport that we had, because that means a lot to me. I don't like to see our sport embarrassed.
Well, that was a tough time in the NBA, and it was a tough time, I'm sure, for the officials, because that Detroit team had that was their personality, that was their style. It wasn't just one night. I mean, that was the way they played, and that was the way they won. So reffing their games had to be a challenge for you guys.
Yeah, you knew when you went out on the court when. You know, you had your hands full, and you just had to attack the game, and technical fouls, ejections, whatever you had to do. But I think that in that particular game, if I remember correctly, and I am correct, I think the game was like 3 minutes to go in the game, and I think it's a 13, maybe 15-point game. And I would have ejected Artest and Ben Wallace and got them off the floor immediately.
Right.
Just got them off the floor. Now you don't have Artest laying on the table. Now the guy's throwing something at him, and now the players start going into the stands and things like that. I would have got rid of them real, real quick. And it's just, but that's what just popped in my head, Ray. I don't know if
that's an interesting one. That's a good one, Joe.
We got about 5 minutes left. A lot. We still want to get in. And you talked about regrets earlier in the Tim Duncan episode being one. You got in trouble with the IRS back in 1998. That I'm sure was, and because you're such a public figure and so well known, it got the publicity. That must have been an embarrassing episode for you.
Oh, it was awful. Yeah, it was terrible. It was. We thought we were all going to get fired, and I really had some problems there and dealing with that. And my lawyer at the time, a good friend of mine, John DiDonato, told me, he says, Joe, he said, true convicts don't care. You made a mistake, and it's eating your stomach out, and it did. And it was just one of those things where it was a part of our package, our financial package with the NBA, but we should have told the IRS about the money that we made, and we didn't. It was going on for a number of years. That was the financial package.
I just want to let the audience, they don't know, if I understand it right, you basically downgraded tickets, you guys, and didn't report the difference.
Yeah, you had tickets. You had plane tickets, and you got, you know, if you didn't go first class, you got the difference.
Right.
And you didn't even think of it, to be honest with you. You just got the money. But we should have. We were wrong. We were 100% wrong, and we paid the price. I mean, it cost me. It cost me dearly. And what it cost me was in my stomach. I still talk about it to this day to people. You know, it was one of the worst things that ever happened to me, you know, in my life.
Ray?
Yeah, I know that was part of actually your collective bargaining agreement as officials, that you had the right to do that. The only mistake that you made was you didn't put it in the W-2. I mean, but you certainly wasn't.
Yeah.
And you said later it was more a misunderstanding than anything else.
Well, I mean, it was the strangest thing in the world, because they came after all of us, and I pled my case. Steve Jabby took his case all the way, and the weird thing is that he went to a jury trial and he won. And there were other referees that weren't prosecuted, and then there were some referees that were prosecuted. So the whole thing was convoluted. To this day, nobody understands it. My attorney, we talk about it all the time because we became really, really good friends. And we talk about it to this day. And he said it was the strangest case he ever had. Some people were prosecuted and some people weren't.
Yeah. Joe Crawford, we got to wrap up, but I want to ask this as we leave. It was a 39-year career. I think I read, I don't know if it's still true, you only got to referee 3 Game 7s in the NBA Finals. You were part of so many legendary games and so much a part of the growth of the NBA from, you know, a smaller league into the powerhouse it is. You're a big part of that. Give us, if you would, the part of the job that you don't miss and the part you miss the most.
Great question. The part I miss the most is just that action, that out on the court. I didn't care whether the game was an exhibition game or a finals game. I missed that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I just missed that in my belly. If my legs were good, I'd be out there today, to be honest with you. What I don't miss is obviously the planes and the hotels, because we were gone 20, 25 days a month. Some months you were on a plane every day, either, you know, going to a game or shooting home for a day. Then you're out on the plane. The planes and the hotels, I do not miss. But that actual being out there, Glenn and Ray, I miss that to my core. I really miss it.
That's great. Well, you're a lifer. It's in the family blood, and you're a lifer. Joe Crawford, I got to tell you, this hour has flown by. It's really been a pleasure, and we appreciate so much you joining us for Tell Us Your Story.
Thank you very, very much for having me, Glenn, Ray. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
It was our pleasure.